Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There are football fans and there are football fans. For some folks, the game is America, and you'd best not trash it in front of them. It's weekend war, a celebration of victory and strength. And then there are the fans who feel guilty watching great athletes go down, joints destroyed, brains hammered into permanent dismay. One of those fans is challenging all of us to look at how we're thinking about football. This hour, On Point, One Man's Revolt. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What kind of fan are you? The diehard who just loves every minute? Or the one who thinks it's gotten out of hand? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me in the studio this hour is Steve Almond. His new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. And you can find an excerpt by going to our website, onpointradio.org. Welcome to the program, Steve. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Jane. It's good to be here.
So the subtitle of your book is One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. You love this game.
Yeah, I do. Yes, I do. Guilty as charged. I feel like I'm in an AA meeting. I am. Yes, I am a football fan. Yeah, I mean, I think it is, and I've rooted for my Oakland Raiders and later the Stanford University team for 4 decades. And I think it is the most fascinating, dramatically satisfying sport in the world. And I think it's also – it's a combination of primal aggression and this incredible dense strategy. There's a zillion different things happening on the field, and yet you also have the thrill of impact, that momentum can swing. As a writer, as a short story writer, I think it has the most it's the richest sport narratively. So, yes, I am totally hook, line, and sinker hooked, or was.
And yet you write, let's have an honest conversation about why we come to football – and about why we need a beautiful, savage game to feel fully alive, end quote.
Yeah.
So when did your feelings change?
Well, they've been evolving. I mean, I think we're at a moral crossroads. That's what I think is happening, is that we're at a moral crossroads as a country in regards to this game. And I think that there is an invisible army of fans who have been feeling increasingly ambivalent and feeling real deep misgivings about the sport. Americans are not good as a rule at interrogating our pleasures morally. Like, we just want to be able to eat the sausage. We don't want to see how it's made. And when it comes to football, I, for years, was eating the sausage. It was terrific. It was amazing. It's so beautiful. I was fully hooked into it, even though I was oftentimes very depressed when I was watching it. And after I would watch it, I'd feel this great emptiness. So I think I felt like a lot of people, let me just have football as a place of refuge, a place where I don't have to live in the age of reason and the age of morality, where it's more or less like I was as a kid. And as you get older and have a family and start to sort of enact your values in the world, I got more and more unsettled by it. And the way I saw football regarded by the rest of the culture was just unconditional approval. And anybody who dares question it is... oh boy, lots of names, lots of not nice names.
So we'll talk about football in our national culture, but start by dissecting the way football is played. What are the problems with the game on the gridiron itself?
Well, the basic problem is that it's a collision sport. And so people will say, well, why don't you write about hockey? Why don't you write about, you know, soccer?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
There's concussions in those games. Look, let's be honest. This is a collision sport. There are multiple collisions on every single play, in every single practice, at every single level, from Pop Warner High School, college to pro. This is a game that's about people, men almost always, and boys coming against one another, and they're getting bigger and faster, and the basic physics of it is that mass times acceleration, right? Boom, equals force.
So has a rough game become a violent game?
No, it's always been violent. It's always been violent in 1905. I mean, it was so bad in 1905, right? This is more than 100 years ago, that Teddy Roosevelt, the president, convened a lot of the leaders of, you know, at that time, collegiate football and said, we got to do something, because 18 young men had died in a single year. Editorials and newspapers were decrying the sport as savage. There would be, you know, cartoons with the Grim Reaper on the field. It's always been a violent game. What has happened in the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years is it's become such a huge business that there has been this incentive for the players to get faster and bigger and stronger. And the medical evidence has finally caught up with the sport. What we realize now is that it's not these big catastrophic hits, which should be alarming to us, but which we can write off as, oh, well, it just happens once in a while. Like when I was 9 or 10 years old, I saw Daryl Stingley, you know, get hit by Jack Tatum, one of my favorite players, and he was paralyzed. And even though I saw that, I could write that off. I should have said, that's just wrong, and I shouldn't watch something this violent as a form of entertainment. But I was a football fan even then. And so I said, well, that only happens once in a while. What the medical evidence now suggests, incontrovertibly, is that it is the accretion of these subconcussive hits that happen in every practice that end up creating the likelihood almost, it's 19 times more likely, according to an NFL commissioned study, that a former player is going to wind up with a brain trauma illness later in life. And most commonly, this CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. That's the reality of it. You cannot remove that from the game because that's the essence of the game. And the people who are making billions of dollars off of football aren't going to remove it because that's what the fans want.
So much attention to this piece, especially in the last couple of weeks, even Broncos wide receiver Wes Welker taken out of a preseason game after Houston's safety DJ Swearinger clashed helmets with him. That was Welker's, third concussion in less than a year. Yep. After the hit, his quarterback Peyton Manning strode over to Swearinger and, well, swore at him. It cost him about $8,000 in fines. Money well spent, Peyton Manning said. Here he is, Peyton Manning, in the locker room after the game, fretting about Welker's injury.
I mean, obviously concerned about Wes and, seeing him coming out of the game. With a potential blow to the head. He had, one of those last year that, kept him out for a while, so I was concerned about him.
And here is DJ Swearinger's response.
NFL is the NFL. I mean, the rules are the rules. I led with my shoulder. That's the only thing I could do. I mean, he's a short guy. I mean, I led with my shoulder. And, I mean, the results are the results, and that's all I could do on that play.
Hey, he's just playing by the rules. And what are you going to say? This is football.
He is right. He's right. He is playing by the rules. It's an inherently violent game. If Peyton Manning was really concerned about Wes Welker as a human being, like as a man, like a fellow human being, if he was concerned deeply about him as opposed to a teammate who's going to help him to some future appointed glory, then he would look at the research around brain injuries. He would say, well, Wes, you've been a great player for many years. Is it worth it for you in 10 or 20 or 30 years to have dementia? Is that worth it for you? I mean, when we talk about I'm really concerned about my teammate, it's always within the context of the game itself and the idea that above all, and this is really capitalism sort of in the gridiron, it's all about winning. And if Wes Welker's going to help you win, then you're concerned about him. But that concern has a parenthesis. I'm concerned about when he's going to come back onto the field.
Yeah. Capitalism in the gridiron. I mean, you get right to it. It's all about money. You said this earlier. Television changed everything. Talk about the big business of football in America.
Well, I didn't know a lot about the business side of football. It's just like I was a fan. And so when I looked into it, it got sort of darker and darker. People talk about the NFL. And by the way, it's always been a business. It's always been the promoters have always recognized that this amazing game that's so dramatically satisfying that there's gold in them, there are tackles. They've always known that. The truth is that the NFL has been masterful at figuring out how to use, and any good corporation does this, how to use their power, how to leverage their power. And recently, basically they were able to have themselves declared as a nonprofit business league. In case you have $2 billion lying around, you too can become part of this business league.
A nonprofit? They have nonprofit status.
They have nonprofit status as a business league, like a local real estate league would have nonprofit status. Well, they have a good lobbyist. That is also how they were able to become essentially a monopoly. They went to, Pete Rozelle back in 1960, wanted to negotiate. All these teams are ostensibly competing, but he wanted to have them collectively bargain with the networks to get the best possible deal. It's all of us or none of us. That's a monopoly, essentially. And what he was able to do is have the Sports Broadcasting Act of 1961 or 62 passed. His lobbyists were able to basically convince the government, the Congress, to pass a law allowing them to become a legal monopoly. That gives them unbelievable power. They're a $10 billion a year business. And a lot of what they do is extort, or I should say, they use our fanaticism for the game to essentially extort cities to make sure that politicians know that they have to keep an NFL team in town or they're going to be voted out of office.
All right, but let's look at it from the opposite perspective. I mean, doesn't a great team in any town benefit in the local economy, jobs and all the rest? There are good things about these teams.
Well, there's good
in
things.
In these towns?
Yes, they make us feel good. And they provide a sense of we're united and fans have a great sense of brotherhood and sisterhood. And it's how we connect to our peers and our family and all walks of life. And that's all true. I'm not arguing with any of that. But the fact is any billion dollar industry is a great engine for any economy. The question is what the NFL essentially does is it comes into these towns. It charges a huge, Houston paid $700 million for a franchise fee. And then the public was stuck with another $250,000 to build a stadium for the owner, help build a stadium for the owner. The profits from that stadium, the games that are played in that stadium, go directly to the NFL and are dispersed to the owners. Okay, they don't go back into the local economy. That's a bunch of low-wage jobs. It's also about 16 games a year. That's a season plus preseason. That's the circus. That's not a year-round model for creating sustainable growth in cities. And you have cities such as Baltimore, for instance, where, they paid $200 million for us in public. The taxpayers paid that money to help build a stadium. That didn't go to schools. That didn't go to a real economic development.
So what's coded into football in America, Steve Allman, that people need to confront, think about before the big game?
I need to think about the fact that this is a profoundly violent form of entertainment that we are consuming, and therefore we have built it. We're the ones who have built it. Any complaints we have about the game, it's our responsibility.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about this country's most popular sport, football, and whether the concussions, the money, the off-field violence and bigotry have taken over the game. I've been speaking with Steve Allman this hour, a fan, a reluctant fan, whose new book is called Against Football. And I'd like now to bring in David Steele, columnist for Sporting News, joining us today from Washington. David, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much for having me, Jane, and it's great to be on with you, Steve.
Yeah.
So, David, big sporting news this weekend with the star San Francisco 49er player arrested on domestic violence charges. This comes just after NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell issued a tougher policy on dealing with players who commit domestic violence after that Ray Rice incident. Here we go again, David, right?
Exactly. And it's so frustrating to see what has developed because you wonder whether or not the players are taking this seriously. You do have a little bit of a hint that the fans are taking it seriously and are holding the NFL to a higher standard. But it's the first time in a really, really, really long time that the fans have really spoken up and gotten the NFL to change anything for the better, because it tends to be usually the opposite way. They tend to just basically support anything that Roger Goodell and the NFL does.
So you think the public the NFL caved to public pressure. Is that right?
It feels that way, and again, it's a pretty rare circumstance because the outcry was so extreme because of the leniency that he handed down to Ray Rice. And I live in the D.C. Baltimore area and got to see it up close, and the reaction not only around the country but within the city and the area of Baltimore and amongst the fans who, as much as they are Ravens fans and they're really fanatics. They could not believe that the league was drawing the line the way that they were.
So weigh in on the big picture here, David. This is your livelihood. You make your living covering sports. What do you make of Steve Allman's arguments, his conclusions here?
Well, you make a great point. It is part of my livelihood, and it it does cause a real dilemma. Steve made a great point by calling it a moral crossroads, and that's the case for everybody because there are a lot of other industries that thrive and survive based on what the NFL does, especially the condition that journalism, particularly sports journalism, is in right now. So much of it is tied into feeding the public what it desires the most. You know, so much is driven by page views and clicks online and on all your devices, and people have an incredible appetite for football at every level. This is with the beginning of college football season. The NFL begins in a couple of days. And just even if you just scroll through the average Twitter feed or the Facebook page of anybody who follows the NFL, it's a nonstop news stream of players who are signed to the practice squad, players who are cut from the very end of the roster. It's just any sort of morsel of information about the NFL, it's just inhaled by the fans, and a lot of the businesses, including this business, feed off of it. And so it would really take a major disruption of everything that we do and everything that a lot of businesses do to sort of tear the public away off of the NFL's teat, basically, mm-hmm. and the teat of the rest of football, all the way down to the lowest of levels. And it gets disheartening to see that sometimes, because you know that there are some incredibly complex and disturbing issues that are going on in the NFL, and then people are perfectly willing to ignore them.
Let's talk a little bit about college football. Steve Allman, you write in your book that college football contains, quote, a legion of lawyers and admin and sports journalists who are handsomely paid to defend and promote corruption and illogic while the rest of us watch. David, do you agree?
100%.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what do we do about college football? What do we do about college football?
And, you know, at certain levels, college football is even more offensive than the NFL right. in a lot of ways, just strictly from the aspect of the excuses that they make up not to pay the players and to not acknowledge that it's a business and to continue to promote this notion of amateurism, which is obsolete, which was false in its very invention, and which, of course, feeds into the NFL and enriches the NFL on so many levels. So I think that any tearing down that needs to be done to the NFL, it can't stop just at the NFL. There needs to be a major correction in how college handles everything well, if not a complete elimination of that entire model.
Steve Allman, everyone sees the pros, but not often talks about the college football scene.
Well, the college football scene, it's a billion-dollar industry as well. But what I find more fundamentally offensive, and I should mention that I'm a huge fan of David Steele's work, and I was one of those football fanatics clicking on his stories because he was a writer for the San Francisco Chronicle and covered the Raiders, and I read his stuff all the time. So I know what he's talking about. We, the fans, are ultimately the ones in power who are feeding this. The college game, if you take a step back, a big step back, the purpose of college, and it is funded by taxpayers, is to enlarge students' minds, to prepare them to contribute to society. It's an educational mission. It is fundamentally perverse and actually just psychotic that we have attached to that an athletic complex that generates an industry that generates billions of dollars. It is even more psychotic that we do that in the high school game. And David is right on mark when he says the NFL really feeds it, because it's all the dream of the NFL and the allure of the NFL that really fuels and trickles down. The commercialization has trickled down to the high school game. You know, we have high school games on ESPN now. What that does, though, is profoundly damaging to the players, and I think to the whole idea of what our educational system is for. There is a study done by a bunch of researchers at Purdue University. They put sensors inside the helmets of 24 high school players, and they wanted to find out what was the impact of concussions, right? How much was it affecting brain activity? They set up a control group. The problem was that the control group, the kids who had never received a concussion, showed diminished brain function. And over the course of the season, by the end of the season, some of them had no function in one of their frontal lobes. These are high school students, Jane. Think about that. If there was a gas leak in the cafeteria that caused diminished brain function in high school students, there would be an uproar the likes of which you've never heard from lawyers, media, right, school administrators. And yet, because it's football, we say, sure, okay, we can have a game that actually causes kids' brain function to diminish. That's craziness.
Exactly. Almost exactly a year ago, fans cringed when University of Cincinnati quarterback and senior Munchie Lego crumbled to the ground during a game after getting hit low while trying to pass. That hit cost him the rest of the season. Here is the play from ESPN.
Munchilego is down
and holding his knee. Now the whole team, for the most part, for the Bearcats coming off the sideline in a show of support for one of their senior quarterbacks. So now somehow everyone has to refocus and get back to football. How hard is that going to be for the Bearcats as they lose one of their two senior quarterbacks?
Refocus and get back to football.
Right, but look, this is the job of the sports media, especially broadcasters, is to normalize the violence. I saw a fascinating film recently called We Could Be King about a Philadelphia school system and this one football team. And there was an amazing moment, Jane, about in the film where there's a two star players and one of them's a small player and he's carrying the ball and he gets tackled and he goes down on the ground unconscious. And the other star player actually starts weeping and becomes disconsolate and starts shouting angrily at the coaches. And what's so remarkable about this, he says, this could have happened to anybody. This could have happened to any of us. This was in practice, and he's weeping inconsolably. And what's so remarkable about that moment is that is a young kid reacting appropriately, morally, to a game that's that vicious that he fears that his friend could be dead.
David Steele, I think I hear Steve Almond saying that it's your job as a sports journalist to normalize the violence. Is that what you do? Is that your job?
Yeah, in a big way, that's part of what we do. We're in a big way part of the sales mechanism for the NFL, for college football, and for all the other levels of football and sports. And this has been kind of the case in sports journalism for forever, certainly as long as I can remember. I mean, just the fact that there's a separate huge, thick section for sports every day in the newspaper. What newspapers are left, of course, which is another story entirely. But it is strange because you do become accustomed to that as a part of the journalism world and as a fan, because this is a normal feature of almost every game. There was a preseason game a couple of weeks ago, and remember, these are just preseason games. These are games that don't count. They don't matter. They're strictly done not necessarily to evaluate the players, but to entertain the fans, to get them out to the stadium one more time and spend, and to provide more TV programming and radio programming. And players were carted off the field from the same team. It was the Cincinnati Bengals, ironically enough, three different times in the span of five plays. And it was this constant shot of the coaches just looking disconsolate and players down on their knees, praying for their teammates' health. And the cart was rolling out, and they're carrying their carting the player off. And one of the players had to be strapped to the board. He has to give the thumbs up to the fans to let them know that he at least has function in his limbs. And then they just move on to the next play.
I remember this from Daryl Stingley and feeling as a 9 or 10 year old, oh my gracious, we're just going to move on. Somebody has been paralyzed right in front of my eyes. The sports media has a job, and it's partly to be as promoters of the game, and that means they have to reduce all of the big moral issues to a momentary scandal. So you talked about Ray Rice, and people did express distress about that. But the larger crisis, if you take a step back, is that we have a game that teaches young men to channel their aggression and express their aggression and be as savage as possible and rewards them for that savagery. And we, the fans, consume that savagery. That's why they have parabolic mics, and we see the replays over and over again. And then we expect them off the field to be gentlemen role models. Or a sport, Jane, that defines femininity and womanhood as something that's basically sexual and ornamental, and masculinity is savage and aggressive and tough. That's the fundamental moral questions that fans need to be asking themselves, and it's scary as can be because they just want to see it as a game.
Let's get some fans, some listeners in here now. Gene is in Miami, Florida. Hi, Gene. Welcome to One Point.
Hi, Gene. I'm not a fan, but I'd like to venture a comment and an observation just
okay.
The same. I follow this conversation closely, and I think, as mores change in the society, like from a bigger picture, right?
Okay.
As mores change in the society, that what we allow to entertain us also changes. Take the example, I'd like to draw a parallel with Spain. Bullfighting in Spain has a longer history and tradition than football in the United States. For, millennia, the Spanish have been bullfighting, but the province of Catalonia has recently outlawed it. And they've taken the arenas where they used to do the bullfighting, and they turned them into concert, venues. And so, I think even at one time, feeding Christians to the lions was entertainment. We wouldn't even consider that today. So we're on a, we're like on a path I'm encouraged by this conversation. I mean, I was born and raised in this country in and around football, never took to it. But I really appreciate this conversation because it raises everyone's awareness about it. We're openly speaking about it. And, I mean, at this point, you know, all I could say, my comment would be, hooray, you know, let's go as Americans. We can do this. We can move beyond, you know, football and find another expression for our nationalism and our masculinity.
All right, Gene, I get the message. Thank you very much. You want to let football go? Here's Aaron with another perspective from Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Aaron. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I am a sports fan. I'm a football fan, and I followed the conversation. And I want to say that I understand the author selling a book, and I even understand the moral outrage that some people might have. But, you know, in our society, and not only in American society, but as, you know, as a civilization, we have a propensity to violence. There's always been violence in our sports and in our activities. That's not going to change. We crave it, and that's just a part of the human nature. Now, what I do have a problem with is this pretense of all of this moral outrage, and because we're so civilized in one part of our society, but you can't put civilization or morals on one part of our society and then leave them out of the rest
not on another.
Of our society.
Aaron, right. Thank you. I'm going to jump in here and let Steve respond.
Well, I absolutely, you know, it's hard. Look, America is part of the point of the book is that Americans have always regenerated our spirit through violence, right? From the colonies to the frontier, cowboys and Indians. Part of what the American spirit is about is that we seek violence as a form of spiritual renewal. But it's also true, as you know, the first caller was saying, that it's possible to make moral progress. The problem is that it's inconvenient. And there are people who have a whole suitcase full of rationalizations. And I'm sure David has heard them all and everybody who's a big fan. We have our suitcase full of rationalizations to justify why we think it's okay to consume a form of entertainment that is violent enough to cause brain damage in the men who play it. That's actually not okay, and it degrades all of our empathy. And the players themselves, guys like Wes Welker, are playing up to a code that we establish as fans because we want to see them. They're valuable to us just as long as they're willing to partake in this violent game and excel at it. And after that, we don't want to think about them.
Here's Leon from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, Leon. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Go ahead.
In terms of player safety and what the NFL either has done or should be doing, refer back, I believe it was the 2011-2012 season when former Texas Longhorn quarterback Colt McCoy up in Cleveland was taken out of the game by Steelers defensive lineman James Harrison. Harrison was thrown out of the game for targeting, and like I said, Colt McCoy was taken out of the game and was originally missed quite a few games, and that was what I remember was causing the big uproar in the NFL in terms of player safety and what was going to happen to the players who were accused of targeting, be it suspensions or fines and things like that. And ever since then, that has, I mean, you see it any game, anyone who even gets close to the head will get some sort of a fine. And then in terms of how the media kind of pushes player safety to the wayside. I remember watching Rutgers whenever Eric LeGrand suffered his injury. And so it's one of those things that does tug at your heart, and it's very sad to see something like that. And you do either change the channel and you just don't want to watch any more of that, or you just continue watching and you hope to hear reports throughout the games how the player's doing. So I think it really stems to fans themselves, you know, at what point are they willing to say, okay, I've had enough of watching that particular game or even that sport, and they decide to go to something else.
Leon, thank you.
Yeah, that's what it's going to take. And people, like, that's the answer that nobody wants, is that it actually ultimately redounds on the fans to somehow, because that's the only way that a huge billion-dollar business is going to change. The NFL is a corporation, okay, where their conscience should be is a cash register. And they've shown that over and over again. The reason that they're being sued by 4,500 former players is not just because they want the players want their medical bills paid. It's because they're accusing the NFL of consciously covering up the link between the sport that they played and brain damage and damage to the brain. That's what they did for years, and they got away with it because ultimately the fans let them get away with it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about reforming football's culture, cutting down on injuries, taming its players' worst behavior, and our own worst impulses as fans this hour. You can join the conversation. Let's hear your list of changes. Let's hear your non-negotiables, the things you do not want to see changed in the game of football. My guests are Steve Allman, author of the new book called Against Football, and David Steele, columnist for Sporting News. I'd like now to introduce one more voice into the conversation, a really expert voice with a lot of firsthand experience of this game. Nate Jackson was a tight end for the Denver Broncos, the San Francisco 49ers, and the Cleveland Browns in an NFL career that lasted from 2002 until 2009. Now he's a writer. His book, out in paperback, is called Slow Getting Up, a story of NFL survival from the bottom of the pile. And he joins us from Portland, Oregon today. Nate, it's so great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So as a player, what did you think of what you've been hearing here?
I think it's all really interesting, and I think it's a really important conversation to have. And as a player, it's interesting to hear it also because the players are the only ones really that are left out of all these decisions always in football matters, whether it's on the field or it's off the field. The players don't have any say in the way they live their lives, in the way they play the game, in the rules that they have to follow. And so I think until that changes, counting on an existential crisis or dilemma to fix the game is going to be really difficult.
So give us an example of that, Nate, a rule that a player doesn't have say over.
Well, the headshots, the way that they enforce penalties, to me is more of a public relations move than it is an actual concern about health or safety. There is no healthy or safe way to bring another man to the ground. Roger Goodell kind of knows this, and he knows that everyone is so big, so fast, so strong. It's impossible to legislate the point of impact, meaning it's impossible to pick exactly where you're going to hit another man who's constantly moving. And the tackle itself represents, like Steve was saying, a very, very small percentage of the actual football hits that are happening. But the way they enforce their headshot penalties is based on tackles. But every play, everyone's blocking head first. That's how we're taught in these meeting rooms. And so there's a interesting dichotomy between the way the league enforces these rules and the way we are taught in meeting rooms. We are taught to turn ourselves into weapons, into missiles, and you do that by using your forehead.
So when you saw Wes Welker just get his third concussion in the last 10 months, what was your reaction? What did you think? Time to go or just plow on? What did you think?
The logical thing would say time to go, but it's easier for us to say that out here when you're inside of that life. Wes Welker's entire identity is wrapped up in the game. The way everyone treats him in his life is based on how he performs on the field. And as a football player, when you're not playing, when you're not performing, you feel like your life's purpose has been booted. I don't exist unless I'm on that field playing football. The way your family treats you, the way your friends, the way the media will jump all over someone they believe is not tough enough. We saw that a couple years ago with Jay Cutler, a former friend of mine who was injured in an NFC Championship game, and he pulled himself out. And over the next week or two, he had to field questions and watch on TV as people speculated as to whether he was tough enough to play the game and whether he wanted it bad enough. And so players are always being judged by all these people, and it affects us. It affects how we live our lives. And even after stepping away from the game and thinking about all this very critically and understanding the perils, when I was playing, I had to be dragged off the field, really. I mean, I was going to play until no one else wanted me, and it had a very, very powerful control over my body. As long as people are out there watching, these guys will be playing. As long as they're paying to watch, these guys will play. and they'll do it until everyone leaves the stadium.
Mm. Steve Allman, that's a key piece of this.
Yeah, and I think actually Nate's book, Nate, it's such a fantastic book, Slow Getting Up, because it really takes you inside what it is like to be a player. And what I was struck by, Nate, is you're just hurt all the time. You're constantly expected to perform at the highest level, but you're also, I mean, half the book is you in recovery, suffering from one injury or another. Fans really don't see that. You know what fans see? They see game day. They see whether their guy on their fantasy football team is going to be, you know, is healthy this week. And frankly, they're angry if he's not. There's this ethos amongst the fans that's so entitled and psychotic, really. It's like, these guys are just meat. These guys are the ones who are supposed to perform heroically as a proxy for my little ego drama that's going on. And they're ultimately objectified and degraded. And that becomes very apparent when you talk to any professional athlete, that that's a whole human being that's been told all their life that why they matter is because of what they can do on the field.
Let's get a caller in here, Chelsea in Princeton, New Jersey. Hi, Chelsea. Glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to bring up an element of the conversation that I'd love for some of our guests to speak to. I attended a very large Division I institution where football was really huge. I actually volunteered as a football recruiter. And one thing that I noticed is the impact that football culture, particularly college football culture, has on young men of color and the ways that young men of color are disproportionately impacted by some of these elements that we're talking about, some of the harm that football and football culture can cause. For example, disproportionately many, many young men of color would come with these high hopes of obtaining their education, and so few of them would actually graduate from the institution with that degree, and they would end up coming away instead with injuries and with other things that would last them for their entire life, but without having that social mobility that a lot of, I think, college institutions will say that they give to their young men of color who they recruit to be their football stars. So I was wondering if folks would like to comment on that racial element.
Excellent point, Chelsea. I'm so glad you called. Thank you. Steve.
Well, one of the most disturbing things, I actually think this is the most disturbing part of this whole equation. You know, when I was in Miami, I just was a reporter, and I basically spent a year in a place called the James Scott Homes, a housing development in Liberty City. And the whole culture there was really dedicated to the idea of football as your economic salvation. Parents would talk about it, and coaches would talk about it. That's what young men without a lot of economic prospects otherwise, and almost inevitably young men of color, that was the path that they were supposed to take. But that's a false dream that we are selling, and it's not an adequate substitution for real forms of actually providing equality of opportunity. One out of every 500 kids who plays high school football is going to become a pro player. And as Nate knows, a pro player is like the average career is 3 years. They are not going to make a life. They are not going to contribute to society by being sold that false dream. A lot of what we do, and I think it is racially skewed, is essentially these kids are harvested from economically vulnerable neighborhoods, and they are desperate for the idea of having meaning in the world, being an important person in the world. And we tell them the only way to have that meaning is not the content of their character or their mind, but what they can do on the field as a physical prowess.
David Steele, speak to that point.
Yeah, that's the most heinous part of all of this for me as well, particularly the college end of it, because that's the group that's taken advantage of the most, that's exploited the most, and the part that has this is not an accident. This is not a mistake. It's not a coincidence that those are the areas that the schools go to recruit these players. They know that they're economically disadvantaged and a lot of times completely academically unqualified. And it's frustrating to hear the arguments in favor of, oh, you guys get scholarships, and what a great opportunity this is. And yet they bring in players, they bring in athletes or students who are clearly not prepared, who have poured all of their emphasis into the athletic side of things. And so they show up at these universities. They're not prepared for academic coursework. The universities use them up and spit them out. They either spit them out back into society or move them on the assembly line into the NFL, where in a lot of other ways they're still not prepared for everything that's going on. So, yeah, there's no doubt question it's a disproportionate effect on African-American
communities. Nate Jackson, weigh in on that point as a player.
Well, the scheduling for the NFL is such that if you're a college student and you have dreams to be an NFL player, or you have some juice going for you and people think you're going to make it, after your season is over, your senior year, you stop going to classes and you get an agent and you start training for the combine, which happens in late February. And so you can't even go to class even if you want that last semester. And so the percentage of guys in the NFL who finished and got their degrees is incredibly low, and it's structured that way that it's nearly impossible for them to get their degrees. And so excuse me. And so I think that that needs to be reformed before we can make any strides. I mean, these guys, once they're like Steve just said, it's about a 3-year career average, and once these guys leave the NFL, they don't have their degrees. And they don't have any idea what to do. Everything's been structured. Everything is on an itinerary. Everyone's telling them what to do and how to do it and where to go. And when they're done, they can be really lost.
Here's Tim in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Tim. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I'm actually also a student at the University of Buffalo, and I've noticed it was mentioned that there was bad behavior to say the least, among some athletes in the NFL. And I noticed that I see that the tolerance of that is something that's negatively impacting people on an even younger level. At my university 2 years ago, actually, there was an instance of a wrestler, not quite football, but a similarly very physically aggressive sport, where they had allegedly assaulted another student. And normally there are jurisdictions against rules in place to keep a person like that out of the for participating in athletics and things like that. There were no charges brought forth against this person legally or athletically. And I think that tolerance just sort of lets people think as though they're above the rules for those who are athletes. And I feel that that sort of player worship is something kind of dangerous and perpetuated by the professional level, but then just keeps getting carried through down through the collegiate level athletics.
This reminds me of the USC story.
Yeah, the USC story, or even more dramatically, you know, Jameis Winston, who won the Heisman Trophy, is the FSU quarterback. He led them to, you know, led them to the championship. He's going to be the number one pick in the draft if he enters. He was accused of raping a young woman. There was physical evidence. There was a friend, one of his friends had video evidence because he'd filmed a portion of the episode. There was all this evidence that at least would have bared investigation. The Tallahassee police did virtually no investigation. Florida State University did virtually no investigation, even though they were legally bound to do so. This is what happens when you give the players this much power and you say that they are as exalted as important as we make football, as fans. That's what we say. We say that this game is so important. It's no wonder that they feel like a different set of rules apply to them, and they're trying to regulate what's going on inside of them. They're told they're important and they're better than everybody else and important, you know, they're aggressive, and off the field, they're supposed to try to regulate that, and it's a recipe for disaster. We see it over and over and over again, and the authorities need to be the ones holding them accountable and don't.
Let's get another call in here from Jared in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Jared. Welcome to On Point.
I'd like to speak about, you know, earlier, we were talking about the fans and how the fans are propelling this game and keeping the game alive, and that if there was change, it would have to come from the fans and their viewing habits, and I think it's worth looking at the fans, you know, in the broader context of America. And, you know, if a citizen is a worker and they, you know, they feel like they don't have power in their lives, they feel like their own lives are dominated, but they feel like they have no opportunity, I think that helps create a hunger, you know, for the type of viewing experience that the NFL provides.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about changing in the NFL, and then we talk about, well, the change has to come from the fans, I think it's worth taking a step further and saying, you know, the way that our society structures power may need to change before we see any real change in the NFL.
Jared, thank you. Steve Allman.
Well, I think that's a really important point, because if you think about it, what the NFL shows us is just the 1% of people who succeed. They don't show us the 499 kids who never make it to the pros, who dream that that's their ticket out. They don't show us what, you know, the communities that build, you know, the taxpayers spend $300 million building a stadium, and you never see the crumbling schools. You never see that the streets are not safe, that the social, you know, fabric of the social, you know, social support systems are, you know, degrading. This is what America does. It's like our biggest reality TV show. We just want to see the rich and famous succeed. When they get hurt, we don't want to have to think about them. It's a winner-take-all mentality, and he's right. It's broader than just football. Football's just the object lesson. It's our most famous example of this.
You have a list of suggestions in the book to change the game. You say things like revoking the NFL nonprofit status, include graduation rates in a college team's national ranking, prohibit tackle football for high schoolers younger than 18. The list goes on and on. I mean, are any of these really feasible?
Well, the question, are any of these really feasible, is part of the problem. There are a lot of people who are posing as realists who are really being cynical. Anything is possible. This is America. You know, we abolished slavery. We were founded upon a sin. We abolished slavery. We gave women the vote, gave them. They should have had it all along. We perpetrated the Great Society, the Civil Rights Movement. America is capable of making moral progress, but it requires that. And this is a game we're talking about. This isn't like a national religion. It's something we consume as entertainment. It is entirely possible if fans actually start to act out their morality rather than just saying, oh, okay, well, Ray Rice did something terrible and I have some qualms about that, but I'm definitely going to watch him in game 3 of the NFL season. People ultimately have to draw a line, and it is upon fans and a lot of the sports pundits. If they're going to complain about the NFL, all right, fine, pal, stand up to it. If you really think it's wrong, turn away from the game. And it's not little measures here or there. There needs to be a fundamental reckoning in this country.
David Steele, chime in here on change quickly.
It can definitely be done. You think of some of the sports that were popular, you
right.
know, a century ago, boxing
most
and horse racing.
Right.
And people shied away from boxing for a lot of the reasons that people are starting to turn away from football now. And horse racing, when you see some of the tragedies that happen on the track with these horses, and it really sinks in what, you know, how brutal and inhumane it can be. People have turned away from that as well. And Steve, you're absolutely right. Anything can be changed. Anything can be – the power can be taken away from anybody. I mean, these are not imperial people. I mean, it's just a commissioner and 32 really, really rich guys.
Right.
You know, the public can do something to take that wealth away, and that means turn away from this sport that is so brutal and dehumanizing and such a negative force on society. It's not that difficult. It just has to take some commitment and a little bit of moral clarity.
Nate Jackson, as a former player, the biggest change you want to see in football?
I'd like to see lifetime health care given to these guys once they leave the game for the injuries that they accrued on the field. As it stands now, the health care runs out 5 years after you're done playing. My health care runs out this week, and then I'll be on my own for the rest of my life with a long list of injuries that I got playing that sport. And so I think we've got to find a way to take care of these guys as they get older, because it's not until 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line that these injuries really, really start to rack the system. And that's one of the things. The other things, I'd like to see Roger Goodell stop implying to the mothers of America that football can be made safe through proper technique. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's a violent sport the way it's coached and the way it's trained. These kids are going after each other.
Nate Jackson, I'm going to stop you there. We're out of time. Thank you so much. What a great panel. Nate Jackson, David Steele, and Steve Allman. The book is Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Many thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.